and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're doing another chef profile.
Yes, it is about time we returned to the personality of people cooking. Well, the last one we did was Julia Child.
Yes.
And that's going to be tough to follow, but I think today's subject is a good follow-up.
Yeah, today we're talking about James Beard.
Yes, of the awards you have probably seen if you don't know who he actually is. And he is infinitely quotable. He had a very big personality.
Yeah.
So one of the quotes of the episode I wanted to start off with, "The only thing that will make a souffle fall is if it knows you're afraid of it." I knew souffles could sense fear.
They can. They can smell it.
I've never successfully made a souffle.
Me neither. I've been blaming my oven, not my fear, this whole time, but...
That's where we were going wrong. That's where we were going wrong. And he has another quote that I love. "I believe that if ever I had to practice cannibalism, I might manage if there were enough tarragon around."
I believe that about him, with or without tarragon, to be super honest.
Are you calling James Beard a cannibal?
I'm saying that he had a great hunger for life and culinary experiences, and that he could be a little bit cutthroat at times. So, not literally, like mostly, not that I've heard of. Oh my goodness, this is going very poorly. James Beard Foundation, please don't put out a hit on me. Not that I'm implying that that's what he did. Oh,
Lauren.
Oh, it's just failing.
It's time to dig Lauren out of this grave that she has put herself in.
Oh, goodness.
So who was James Beard, Lauren? And try not to talk about cannibalism too much.
Okay. James Beard, sometimes called the Dean of American Cooking, at least starting when the New York Times called him that in 1954, is one of the creators or originators or visionaries of modern American food culture. Coming out of the rationing of the World Wars and the Great Depression and rebelling against the industrialization of food and all the dour messaging of temperance and prohibition, and even rebelling kind of against the codified and perceivably stuffy nature of hot cuisine, James Beard promoted the pursuit of pleasure and creativity or crafting through cooking and eating. And especially the elevation of, like, common, traditional, local, sustainable, and frequently poor American foods, elevating those to celebratory status. Like y'all, we all enjoy cheeseburgers, and you can make one that's just as much a delicacy as any hot recipe.
Oh, yeah.
And you can do it with your own two hands, from ingredients produced by your community.
Absolutely can.
And that sounds kind of like pat at this point, but he was saying this in, like, the 1950s.
Yeah.
And it was a revelation to a lot of people, especially because he was saying it, you know, that you don't have to be a chef. You can be a chef or an amateur. You don't have to be a lady. You could be a dude or a lady if you're doing it at home, that this is accessible to everybody. And yeah, it's a message that's just profoundly influenced how Americans cook and eat, both at restaurants and in homes.
What's the thing from Ratatouille? What's the quote?
I've never seen Ratatouille.
Oh, no. Lauren, get out of here now.
Oh, whoa.
No, you can stay.
Oh, thank
you. It's something
you.
Like anyone can be a chef. I don't know. It's much more inspirational or perhaps just said with a fake French accent, so it sounds like that. But essentially, I think it's encapsulating that.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. And James Beard was, as you said earlier, one of those larger-than-life kind of personalities. And he was like 6 foot 4 inches and about 300 pounds, which is around 1.9 meters and 136 kilos for our metric friends. So, you know, literally a little bit larger than life. But yeah, he was one of modern mass media's first celebrity chefs and a cookbook author and essayist and a cooking teacher and just an inspiration to the culinary industry at large, including to that first chef who we profiled, Julia Child.
Yep.
The two of them became great friends, but I didn't mention that in our Julia episode, and I've been kind of kicking myself for it ever since. She once said, "In the beginning, there was Beard."
I love that. That's fantastic.
Right? Oh.
Mm-hmm.
James Beard was also pretty openly gay through a number of decades when that was anything from just distinctly impolite to discuss to outright illegal here in the United States. and perhaps especially in American professional kitchens. He came out publicly in the 1981 revision of his memoir, Delights and Prejudices, just 4 years before his death, but it wasn't really discussed in the food community until the 2000s. Neither his obituaries nor those of his, like, 30-year erstwhile partner, this pastry chef by the name of Gino Cafacci, none of that mentioned their orientation. They would be like, they're great friends.
I'm oh,
like,
sure. Mm. Uh-huh.
I mean, they were, I guess, but... and I don't mention this because... the sexual orientation of any chef or celebrity particularly matters, but rather because it's important to consider the contributions of LGBTQ plus people to American culture, despite and maybe even because of the marginalization and discrimination that they've seen. It's just such an American story, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the face of hardship. So, yeah.
Yeah.
James Beard wrote in his 1949 The Fireside Cookbook, "America has the opportunity as well as the resources to create for herself a truly national cuisine that will incorporate all that is best in the traditions of the many people who have crossed the seas to form our new, still young nation."
Oh.
Yeah.
My little heart.
I know. I know. I got verklempt a little bit in this one, too. These days, also, as Annie said earlier, you might mostly know of Beard through the much-lauded James Beard Awards, which come in many much multiple categories for food writing in cookbooks, media, and journalism, and the restaurant industry for restaurant design, service, and individual chefs. But I am getting way ahead of us.
Yes.
That didn't start happening until after his death.
Mm-hmm.
So let us talk about his life.
Yes, let's do that. James Beard was born on May 5th, 1903, in Portland, Oregon, to English immigrant Mary Elizabeth and John Beard. According to some sources, he was a 13 to 14-pound baby.
Cool.
I certainly hope that wasn't the case, but,
yeah.
Well, whatever the case was. Mary owned the Gladstone, a local boarding house, and John Beard worked at Portland's Custom House. Beard later described his father as a Mississippi gambler type who wore a red carnation, smelled of fine soaps, and was loved by all the ladies, which really paints a pretty good picture of him.
Uh-huh.
His mother sounds fascinating. When she arrived to America from Europe, she was 16 and pretending successfully to be a governess, eventually buying the Gladstone in Portland in 1896, where she ran the hotel's kitchen. Apparently, Portland was quite the bustling port at the time, and one whose description reminded me of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Or Caribbean. At first, she staffed her kitchen with mostly French and Italian immigrants, but to her annoyance, a lot of them up and left after catching gold fever. She found a solution by hiring Chinese workers, some of whose names you might recognize from Beard's recipes and writings: Let, Jin, Billy, and Poi. James Beard was known for his theatrics, and I'd say from reading Barry Fussell's foreword to the Essential James Beard Cookbook, he got that from his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Fussell describes arguments between Lett and Elizabeth over things like the proper way to preserve a fig that turned into fencing matches, Lett armed with a knife and Elizabeth with a piece of firewood. Such arguments usually ended in laughter and not injury. Though, through observing these passionate arguments, along with the melting pot of cuisine from China, from England, and the Pacific, Beard acquired, quote, a love of food. He also described himself as precocious and nasty a child as ever inhabited Portland. At least he was aware. He also had an excellent taste memory, and his first one reminds me of Kung Fu Panda 2.
Oh.
I wonder if anyone will get this reference. We're going to go with it anyway.
I also haven't seen that film.
Oh, man.
Please continue.
As a baby, he found his way into a vegetable bin and ate an entire onion, including the skin. And now, if you've seen Kung Fu Panda 2, and I could go on and on, the panda was found in a radish bin, and he ate all the radishes, and There's a whole cute thing that's involved. Anyway. Moving on, I brought up two children's movies in this episode, and we're very early on. Let's see how many more I can hit.
Yeah.
When he was sick with malaria at 3 years old, he recalled being given chicken jelly. From a young age, his father took him to restaurants in Portland weekly. Let took him to Chinatown, and his mother took him to see the Louvre when he was 5, where he got a taste of French cuisine. However, as he got older, it was acting that called to him, not cooking. He played such roles as Tweedledum in Alice in Wonderland and Mr. Fuzzywig in A Christmas Carol, which I would say is probably pretty good casting.
Yeah, absolutely.
In 1921, Beard was quietly asked to leave Portland's Reed College because he was gay.
Or for having an affair with one of his male professors, at any rate. Though he would say much later that he knew he was gay by the time he was 7 years old, so this wasn't like an experimental phase.
Right.
Yeah.
When the college yearbook published a few weeks after he was kicked out, there was no record of him in it. So he packed up, took a freighter through the Panama Canal to London, and a little later, Paris, to study voice with aspirations of becoming an opera singer?
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, he tried a lot of food. Of course. When singing didn't work in Europe due to a vocal ailment, he set sail for New York City to get back into acting. He landed roles such as Cyrano and Othello at Walter Hampden's Theater. These gigs weren't enough for him to live off of, though, and in 1924, he went back to Portland, started working as a radio announcer, and became a member of a theater troupe. A couple of years later, in 1927, he went to Hollywood, and he landed some small roles in films like Cecil B. DeMille's King of Kings. He did some food commercials for radio in San Francisco, then bounced back to Portland, performing in local theater. Over the next couple of years, he tried his hand at all sorts of things, acting in Seattle, studying costume design at Pittsburgh's Carnegie Tech, back to Portland in 1932. Over the next 5 years, he worked in stage, acted in plays, and taught cooking classes before deciding to head back to New York in 1937 to become a, quote, gastronomic gigolo. That is an excellent title, and I approve wholeheartedly. Somewhere along the line, he started cooking meals backstage for cast or for friends at their houses. When it looked like acting wasn't going to pan out for a while, or at least he needed to make money in the meantime, he and two of his friends, Billy, I called him Billy like we're familiar, but
yeah,
it's Bill.
It's Bill.
Bill and Irma Rode opened a catering business in 1937 called Hors d'oeuvre, and it was quite popular, especially among the rich. And I mean, who else
is getting
catering?
No.
Unless you're a company.
Sure.
And it was well-reviewed. The Daily News wrote, "The brioche onion sandwich gives the palate its great moment."
Oh.
That was the favorite item on the menu.
Yeah, and that was one of Beard's favorite items for the rest of his life. He would talk much about that onion ring sandwich.
Oh, mm-hmm. Now I want to recreate it.
Mm-hmm.
But this finally brings us to Beard's cooking career, and we're going to get into that. But first, a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. So this catering thing was working out pretty well for Beard, and based on his experience in it, he published his first book, Hors d'oeuvre and Canapé, in 1940. And the stated aim of this book was to eliminate, quote, all the various horrors prevalent on the routine hors d'oeuvre tray, including tidbits on toothpicks coyly stuck into a grapefruit.
Coyly stuck in there.
It was a book promoting the kind of cocktail party at which both the guests have a lovely time and the host actually enjoys providing it.
My goodness.
I know, how modern. He took with him into the concept of it his experience in theater. He wrote, "Put on a fine show. Like the theater, offering food and hospitality to people is a matter of showmanship. And no matter how simple the performance, unless you do it well, with love and originality, you have a flop on your hands."
No one wants a flop.
No one wants a flop, especially not—
Oh, wait, no, the producers do.
Oh, that's true. But—
They're very rare.
And they're not making soufflés. He would publish another book, Cook It Outdoors, just a year later. But then his life as a chef and writer was put on hold for a couple years during World War II. He was drafted in 1942, went to cryptography school, and then served with the USS, that's the United Seamen's Service, which was a newly minted organization that provided relief and assistance to seafarers and particularly U.S. armed forces abroad. They still do. Recreation, communication with loved ones, tasty food, that
Ooh,
sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to Julia Child, actually.
Exactly, yeah. But by 1944, Beard was back to work in publishing, and another project was on the horizon.
What project was that, Lauren?
Television.
The small screen?
The small screen!
The small screen, yes!
In 1946, NBC's flagship channel, WNBT, in New York City, had a really successful culinary segment on this daytime variety show, and so the station wanted to do a full food show. James Beard's I Love to Eat premiered on NBC in 1946. It was a show demonstrating recipes, probably the very first network cooking show, though some local stations had been broadcasting cooking demonstration shows or segments as early as 1939.
Mm-hmm.
I Love to Eat would run until 1947, first 15 minutes per episode, then 30 minutes, including live advertisements.
Live advertisements?
My favorite kind. However, no footage remains because it hadn't really occurred to anyone yet that television might be saved for posterity, that, like, anyone would care beyond it airing in the immediate moment. Although apparently there is at least one audio recording of an episode featuring a ski resort luncheon.
He was at a ski resort?
I think he talked about going to a ski resort.
I hope he was there.
I mean, I hope he went to some. That
sure,
sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Sure.
A luncheon, too.
In the only second least expected cameo of the episode, the show was produced by Patricia Kennedy, who worked on it while campaigning for her brother John Kennedy's very first congressional run.
Wow.
Hmm.
Huh.
In the actual least expected cameo of the episode, legendary special effects artist Dick Smith, whose toxic blood recipe I mentioned in our SFX episode, was the makeup artist for this show.
Was there a lot of fake blood involved?
No, just normal like screen makeup, you know, making someone like all like matte. And if they are super bald, like, for example, James Beard was drawing. He drew some hair onto the top of Beard's head to make it less shiny under the lights.
Oh, my goodness. The true special effects.
Right? Yeah. But the show did not last. As dynamic and personable as Beard was in real life, he wasn't really great on camera. He'd later appear in three episodes of The Mike Douglas Show, a daytime variety show in the 60s and early 70s, but that was really it. Later still, he and Julia Child tried to get a show together for the American Bicentennial of 1976. It was going to be about pre-revolutionary American cooking. And I really wish they'd been able to make it happen. It sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
I think that they wish it had happened, too. They called themselves L'Enfant Barbu, the bearded child, when they hung out together.
Oh,
which is
adorable.
Really cute.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, with Paul Child's failing health and Beard's lack of camera sparkle, the project was scrapped.
Oh, man.
However, the good sales of Beard's books and the boost from the TV market just catapulted him to fame within the New York City food scene in the early 1950s. He formed this feverish publishing schedule with new books out at least every couple years, frequently several at a time, all in the same year. And the culinary community in those early years in New York City is reported to have been competitive and kind of strained, but Beard kept with it and took on so many side hustles. A gig at Sherry Wine and Spirits, where he learned the wine industry and wrote for their catalogs. Columns for magazines and newspapers that would wind up getting nationally syndicated. An update of the classic standard bartender's guide. And cooking classes. More and more cooking classes. He would earn that title from the New York Times, the Dean of American Cookery, in 1954. In 1955, he established the James Beard Cooking School in New York City and an offshoot in Seaside, Oregon, to formalize his consultation and cooking instruction businesses. In 1959, he was invited to help plan the menu for this new restaurant venture in New York City, one that hoped to establish American cuisine as something that could be just as fine and fancy as classical French. The Four Seasons.
That the Four Seasons?
That the Four Seasons.
Heavens to Betsy.
And, yeah, their plan kind of worked.
Hmm.
They were fairly successful.
I would say so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a hot spot of the glamorous for decades. Jackie Onassis called it the cathedral.
Whoa.
I know. I love it.
Yeah.
And Beard's influence in that success was strong. He would purchase a brownstone in the posh and booming Greenwich Village area in 1960, which became the seat of his culinary empire, host to his classes and these fabulous parties, though he would continue to travel, offering lectures and classes around the world. 1960 is the same year that Beard probably met Julia Child for the first time. Through common connections, he threw this party for her when she came back to the United States from Europe, just a year before Mastering the Art of French Cooking, finally published.
And the rest is history.
And such was his popularity that in 1964, he would release the first edition of that Delights and Prejudices, a memoir with recipes.
Every memoir should come with recipes.
Right?
Let's just be real.
Why wouldn't you? Oh.
Yeah. Now we've got to come up with what our memoirs, what recipes they will come with.
Oh, goodness. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've got like 17 just popped to my head simultaneously.
Fantastic.
And this is kind of moving towards the wind down of Beard's life. In 1976, he would receive an honorary degree from the aforementioned Reed College, which seemed to settle the bad blood between them. In his final will and testament, Beard instructed that his Greenwich home be sold with the proceeds going to Reed College.
Oh, that's nice.
He had a beloved pug during these years named Percy.
Of course he did.
Percy the pug. The pug received meals directly from the Greenwich Brownstone's longtime steward.
Mm-hmm.
And Percy would sometimes wear a bow tie, just like Beard, for special occasions.
Okay. I'm still trying to fit as many children's movies into this as I can. I'm
okay.
Pretty sure the dog from Pocahontas, the pug, was named Percy.
Oh, I think it was.
I wonder if it was based on this.
Oh, goodness.
Further research.
I don't think it was wearing a bow tie, but it did have a little ruff.
Yeah.
Or
he definitely had some kind of fancy.
Perhaps a hat.
Yes. Just to show.
Delightful English chapeau.
Yes.
Around this time, however, James Beard's health wasn't great. Sort of conveniently, Nouvelle Cuisine was on the rise, having started in France as a reaction to the heavy sauces of haute cuisine and promoting, lighter, fresher preparations. That, plus his prescribed diets from doctors, would influence his later recipes. He had heart and circulation problems. Apparently, when he wound up in hospitals, his friends, the Four Seasons would deliver food to him, and his friends would sneak in champagne and scotch against doctor's orders. As an article on the Daily Beast put it, understanding that for Beard to live without what he loved was to not live at all.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beard also struggled with depression, and his delight in gossip could turn a little bit macabre, as the Washington Post once described it, pitting friends and colleagues against one another. And I need to put in here, because I did the research and I cannot ignore it, one essay that I read noted, secondhand, a scenario during Beard's later years that I can only describe as, and if you'll pardon my French and please bleep me, some Harvey Weinstein where he made a young aspiring pastry chef deeply uncomfortable by exposing himself during what was supposed to be a professional conversation. And the description makes it sound like it was not the only time that that kind of thing happened. I read about it in the essay, America, Your Food is So Gay, which is a great title for anything, originally published in the now-defunct Lucky Peach magazine. If you would like to read more about it, it's a pretty good essay, though be warned that the author didn't seem to see this episode is harassment. He kind of mentioned it like, oh, that wacky Beard.
Him.
Oh, yeah. He's so hedonistic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And, I'm not going to in any way excuse or pardon this behavior. I hope it didn't happen very often. And in order to prevent sexual harassment, we all, though perhaps especially those of us in positions of social power, need to think more and better about consent.
Absolutely.
Soapbox of the episode. Beard also drew criticism from friends and competitors around this time for selling out. He had many, many lucrative product endorsement deals, and lots of his later recipes called for ingredients that were in line with that. You know, like frozen peas or canned corn, for example, due to his affiliation with Green Giant.
Mm-hmm.
These and other large corporate endorsements must have also, like, really not helped with his kind of depression and self-hatred sort of issues. Because, you know, he was this longtime supporter of fresh and local foods and probably made him feel away.
Mm-hmm.
But although Beard was troubled during this period of his life, he was also doing good. In 1981, he helped found the charity City Meals on Wheels with New York Magazine restaurant critic Gail Green, who had realized that meal deliveries to homebound folks stopped over holiday weekends in New York. They delivered 6,000 meals that first year, and the organization is still around today, having delivered its 50 millionth meal in 2014.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Beard would pass away in 1985 of a heart attack at the age of 81. He was working up until his death. What would be his 22nd and final cookbook, Beard on Pasta, was published in 1983. And at the time of his death, he was working on a more personal, kind of gossipy memoir. His ashes were spread on the coast of Gearhart, Oregon, where his family spent summers when he was a child, gathering shellfish and berries and cooking their meals with whatever the day had brought them.
That sounds lovely.
It does.
He sounds like he was the Stephen King of publishing cooking books.
Oh, yeah. He was extremely prolific.
We still have a little bit more about James Beard.
Oh, yeah, because absolutely, his memory has persisted far, far, far beyond the actual man. And we'll get to that after one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
All right, so let's talk about that award.
Yes.
Yes. In 1986, a year after James Beard's death, a group of his friends and chefs, led by Peter Kump and Julia Child, purchased his townhouse after a successful fundraising campaign. And they started the James Beard Foundation with this mission statement: to provide a center for the culinary arts and to continue to foster the interest James Beard inspired in all aspects of food, its preparation, presentation, and, of course, enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
Kump, who had started a theater troupe once upon a time, set up the space as sort of a cooking theater, drawing chefs like Wolfgang Puck. Nowadays, the Beard House sees 250 events a year.
Both fledgling and famous chefs from around the country come to host these lavish dinners there for like 70-ish people at a time in Beard's own parlor and former bedroom. He had a mirror on the ceiling above his bed, and one table now sits right under it.
That doesn't surprise me at all, somehow.
Not one bit. The food is all cooked in his own apparently cramped and slightly ill-equipped kitchen, and it's considered something of a rite of passage, or at least a useful publicity stunt for American chefs.
Mm-hmm. Aside from that, the foundation offers scholarships and educational programs. To date, $3.5 million has been awarded to culinary students. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen the James Beard certification or heard the phrase James Beard award-winning restaurant, possibly from me when I'm talking about the Atlanta airport. It has one. The James Beard Foundation Awards were first given out in 1991, and they're known as the Oscars of the food world. And speaking of Oscars, I thought I'd note Silence of the Lambs won Best Picture that year.
So many things about eating and enjoying yourself.
Exactly, right?
Perfect.
It seemed important, and also worth noting, more relevant, is that these awards were first handed out pre-celebrity chef days, and for the most part, pre-internet days. So it was a way of recognizing chefs behind the scenes. Nominees for the first award ceremony were alerted via telegram, and some had not a clue what the James Beard Foundation was. These awards got started with the help of some funding from two companies we've discussed before on the podcast, Joseph E. Seagram & Sons and Champagne Pierre Jouet. For transparency, an awards committee was set up independent and separate from the Beard Foundation, and each year regional judges are judged to make sure they're eligible. They had to demonstrate knowledge of the industry and sign affidavits that they didn't have any conflicts of interest. Mm. Members and staff at the Beard Foundation do not vote. They aren't allowed to. The ceremony has become quite the spectacle.
Oh, yeah. Real big.
Yeah. In 2005, then Foundation President Lynn Pickle, I can't believe that's actually his name, had to resign due to a criminal investigation, and the awards were almost caught off. Almost.
There's all kinds of buzz about, like, embezzlement and weird stuff. It was most of the newspaper articles I wrote about it were like, James Beard would really appreciate all the drama going on about his foundation.
I bet he would. Mm-hmm. I bet he would. The chair of this year's James Beard Award Committee is Atlanta chef Anne Quattrano, by the way. She has a restaurant in this very building.
Oh, yeah. They mm-hmm. do great work around time. Mm-hmm. Around town.
Around town.
Mm-hmm. In 2011, a playwright by the name of James Still premiered a one-man stage show about Beard called I Love to Eat. Mm-hmm. It's been run on various stages, and reviews have tended to not be particularly shining, but I am just tickled that Beard finally got to return to his first love, the stage.
And it was called I Love to Eat.
I know.
Yeah.
In 2017, PBS released a documentary about Beard called America's First Foodie.
In 2020, the James Beard Public Market will open in Portland, Oregon.
Hypothetically, hopefully.
Yeah.
The project has seen a number of difficulties, but its mission is to provide the type of year-round, daily public market of products from local farmers and wineries and breweries and restaurants with permanent vendors and some temporary stalls and restaurants and a teaching kitchen. It sounds like a really nice thing.
It does, yeah.
And I'm that verklempt thing again, and— Okay, part of it might be because I was researching a lot of this, like, late at night, drinking rosé from a can, but Beard was this amazing and vibrant personality, and really, I think that visionary isn't unfair. Or, you know, at the very least, he was just very in tune with the next big thing and very savvy about marketing it. A friend of his, Joe Baum, described Beard as someone who cooked the way he dressed. He would combine plaids, stripes, and prints, and it worked. And he'd do the same with food. And I feel like Beard was born 50 years too early for himself, and yet exactly when America needed him.
Oh, that's lovely, Lauren.
No, thank you.
The rosé in a can served you well.
Thanks.
I'm frantically trying to think of one last children's movie reference. But
not that many of them feature rosé in a can, so.
I don't know why.
Me neither.
But this brings us to Listener Mail. I like that one.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, this first one is from Philip, and he wrote in about our Kale episode with one of the, I have to say, festivals I am most interested in attending at one point in my lifetime.
Oh, wow.
And this is going to say a lot about me, actually.
That's high praise. Okay. Mm-hmm.
In northern Germany, you eat kale after the first frost hits. It is only harvested then because the frost makes the kale less bitter. The harvest starts a whole kale season. Especially in the countryside, people go on kale tours where you hike through the countryside with a handcart filled with grain schnapps and tea and coffee. During the tour, a game called Bolseln is usually played. The whole group is divided into two teams, and each team has to throw a ball along the way. The team that has the lower number of throws at the end of the tour wins. The losing team has to drink another grain schnapps, which is only going to improve your performance, I'm sure. If the ball lands in a ditch, there is even a special device to get it out. It is called a Kräber, which is essentially a broomstick with a metal basket on top of it. Kale tours usually end at a traditional inn or restaurant where large amounts of kale, sausages, and Kassler, which is a type of smoked pork, similar to gammon steak but not the same, with boiled potatoes and hot mustard are eaten along with lots of beer. It's Germany after all. After the kale meal, one drinks an ice-cold kale schnapps, which is made of vermouth, juniper, and other botanicals, and a kale king and queen are elected. This doesn't have to be democratic, though. Sometimes those who ate the most kale are elected. They get a kale stalk as a scepter and sometimes a necklace with the names of previous kale royalty. For this privilege, they have to buy everyone a schnapps and organize the kale tour next time. My home state of Lower Saxony also elects an official kale king or queen every year. It is always a politician, And every German chancellor so far has been elected king or queen at some point. A lot of clubs and societies, as well as political parties, organize kale tours or kale dinners for their members during kale season, and I usually get invited to at least 24 kale dinners and tours during this time.
What?
We have to go. There's no question, Lauren.
That's beautiful.
It is.
I had no idea.
I hope that the kale scepter, I know it's probably just this, a piece of kale, but I hope it's this, like, big thing.
Oh.
You get to wield it. Threaten people with it.
Yeah. Well, it's not a kale spear. It's a kale scepter.
Yeah. Think of the power.
I know.
Kale power.
Pure kale power.
It'd go to my head, Lauren.
I think it's going to your head already.
Yeah, I'm like having visions of being a future kale queen. Oof.
Mindy wrote in, I've been a proud Trekkie. Yes, Trekkie, what's this Trekker nonsense? Since I was a little girl watching The Next Generation with my mom. I even said I wanted to be an astronomical engineer when I grew up because Star Trek got me to love space and I liked pressing buttons. Anyway, while you touched on some of the great fictional foods, my two favorite Star Trek food stories revolve around what happened with those foods in regards to real life. In Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, there's a scene with the original crew having dinner with a bunch of Klingons talking about Shakespeare, and on their plates is this mysterious blue glob of something. Turns out those globs were actually squids dyed bright purpley blue, getting warmer and warmer under set lights. Since it was a dinner scene, the director needed shots of people eating, which no one wanted to do, and it got to the point that he ended up bribing the cast $20 for every shot of one of them eating. William Shatner was the only one, and after the take, looked the director straight in the eye and went, "Where's my $20?" The second story deals with the favorite booze of the Kardashians. I'm sorry, I meant Cardassians. Wink. Knarr. For those that don't know, Knarr is thick, usually black fluid that has the consistency of honey or corn syrup. In fact, dark corn syrup is what it was originally made of. However, when it was first drunk on DS9, they had to do so many takes that the actor, Casey Biggs, got so sugar high and wired and generally insane due to drinking cup after cup of corn syrup, they changed the recipe to sugar-free pancake syrup.
Probably for the best.
For the good of all of us. Yes.
Yes.
Oh.
I want to go work on my William Shatner impression.
Yeah, I was just thinking that I'm sorry that I don't have a good one.
Where's my $20?
That's pretty good.
That's a lot of work I got to do. But
it's serviceable at any rate.
Thank you.
It's better than I did, which is not trying. So thank you, Annie.
We're both going to take a day this week and just practice our Shatner impressions.
Oh, that's going to be a great day. The rest of the office is going to love us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to be so popular.
We can do it right behind everyone's desk in rotation.
Yeah, and I'll have my kale scepter.
Perfect. Mm-hmm.
And I'll just whack people randomly.
Yeah.
We're real nightmares around the office, you guys.
Apparently. Goodness.
Yes. Also, we're never going to get invited to the James Beard Awards, but we're open to it.
Oh, yeah.
If, yeah.
You know, we're waiting with bated breath.
We're sure
for
you just
our invitations.
We're sure you just lost our email address. And speaking of, you can email us. Please, one of the reasons we did this episode is because people suggested, please do another chef. So if you've got an idea for one, please send it to us. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Foodstuff HSW, stands for How Stuff Works, and on Instagram at Foodstuff. We hope to hear from you. Thank you so much to our audio engineer today, Tyler, and our super producer, Dylan Fagan. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.